Hello, I'm Dr. Stephen Hassan with another episode of The Influence Continuum. And today I'm speaking with Nigel Denning from Melbourne, Australia, a colleague, a friend. Nigel's a counseling psychologist and managing director of the Integrative Psychology organization in Melbourne, Australia. And I'm just going to not say all of your laudatories, Nigel, but you have master's degrees in English as well as counseling psychologist, formerly a member of the Victorian State and National Executive of the College of Counseling Psychologists, where you were responsible for creating many learning opportunities for psychologists. You got interested, Nigel, a long time ago in the issue of high demand groups and cults in the 90s, where you first encountered respondents to the now infamous Melbourne or Archdiocese response developed by the late Cardinal George Pell, which intended to silence complainants of abuse within the Catholic Church. However, you went on to take a significant role as a whistleblower supporter to the abuse that was taking place, and that led to the deep involvement with the Pell prosecution that eventually delivered findings during a group visit to the Vatican in 2017. You also were involved with the infamous Hindu cult based in outer Melbourne in 2013, where you co-developed a group approach to support almost 100 survivors of this cult. And since then, you've had direct experience with survivors of more than 20 different groups, ranging from religious cults, self-development groups, New Age groups. And I should also say, Nigel, you and I both share a teacher together, Daniel P. Brown, both for clinical psychology education as well as learning about his Tibetan Buddhist approach to meditation, Pointing Out Way. And we met in person when you came to the States, and we talked about, like, let's do something together. And it's been many years since I've last been to Australia, so we're talking about a program in 2024 there that we can record and put online together. And I want to say that you are very interested in theory of mind, that you've studied metacognition extensively with leaders of the field. You have studied with famous people, including Dan, John Gottman, and Daniel Siegel, just to name a few. You also were a pioneer in the training and application of holotropic breath work, which you studied under Stanislav Grof and Tav Sparks in the mid-80s. What am I missing? Oh, yeah, you did a lot of research in psychedelic use in clinical settings. And I believe Australia has now legalized use of some psychedelics. So we're going to have a fun interview. And I really, most of my listeners are in the United States, but I definitely have folks in Australia as well as Europe and Asia. But I thought it would be really great to tap your expertise, both as a therapist, but also as someone who's very interested in spiritual frameworks, too, to connect the dots of what is healthy human development. And with that, welcome, Nigel Denning.
Good morning or good evening, Steve.
It's evening for me and it's morning for you. It's a whole bunch of hours different. So thanks for getting up so early. So Nigel, tell us about what you most want to convey to my audience about the mess the world is in, the pain and suffering and confusion people have, and what especially, you know, therapists should be learning about to greater support clients.
Yeah, that's a big question, isn't it?
Take your time. We only have an hour, but no, I'm just kidding you. Go ahead.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think what's really the most important thing for us to sort of start really understanding is how the mind really works. And I think, you know, that this is what sort of has really taken me with your work and the work you've been doing over so many years in this idea of influenceability.
Yep.
And, you know, if we don't have a clear understanding of how the mind works, then we don't have then opportunities both to optimize the mind, but also to protect it from the interests of other people. So this is where, you know, I got very interested in the organization of mind through Dan Brown's work. He introduced a structural concept called the three pillars approach to his psychotherapy. And it's a very elegant kind of model that talks about the need to create a collaborative relationship, which is a very overt, very, very clear relationship in therapy. You know how I'm thinking and theorizing, and you know you're being honest with me, and that's a very strong human motivational system collaboration. Mm-hmm. And then the second component, the general component, is metacognition, which is an understanding of how the mind's organized.
Yeah,
and then we just have a treatment involved. So the more we can educate people about how the mind works, the various stages of mind, you know, we all know that, you know, people remember things they feel, not what they think.
Mm-hmm.
So having an understanding of the interaction between cognition, affect, sensation, memory, and it's all done through relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, none of us become a self without other selves feeding into that.
Right.
So We know ourselves through relationships. So this becomes a really, really important idea to grasp, which I don't think is really part of a lot of conversations in the community at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, what is this thing going on inside our heads that we call a mind? We've got this incredible industry around psychology at the moment that looks at problems that people experience.
Right.
And so we focus on negative state almost exclusively in psychologies and psychiatrists, and we focus on ameliorating the suffering of those negative states, which is an important part of the work. But we lose the opportunity for growth, development, freedom, all of these sort of features that are you know, a very important part of our species, our minds.
Yes.
We don't do anything to support and build on that. And, you know, having worked so long in complex trauma, you know, what I see is that unless we can find ways for people to make sense and meaning from their trauma, and that's a famous book by Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning.
Right.
You know, finding that purpose and that sense of meaning is absolutely critical for any kind of healing process.
Right.
And you know, we don't do enough of it in our culture. So, you know, when we're talking about the ills of the world, I think, you know, educating people to understand how minds work,
mm-hmm.
therefore how they don't work or how they're influenceable,
right,
becomes an incredibly important feature.
Yep.
The conversation.
So did you cover the three pillars? I counted two, but
So, yeah, so collaboration, metacognition, and treatment.
Got it.
So we learned it. Dan wrote a book with David Elliott that was published in 2016, which won the Genet Prize for best clinical literature for that year. And they use the structure of collaboration and metacognition to repair attachment.
Attachment repair. I have the book myself, and I've attended Dan's trainings on it. And attachment is the rage, but very few people understand what Dan has learned about teaching people how to repair their own traumas, including neglect, as well as traumatic things that were done. And I've implemented it in my treatment with former cult members. It's absolutely crucial that the neuroplasticity, the neurogenesis that we now know is documented. And I've always kind of said, it's your mind, you should control it. And I've been, you know, trying to have more of a coaching frame with my clients rather than I'm the authority figure, I'll tell you what to think or feel. but rather let me share what's worked in my journey of healing. Let me share what I've learned with other clients, and you tell me what fits and what works for you.
Yeah. The very important point you make there in terms of trauma and neglect, omission trauma is something that really doesn't get anywhere near enough airplay in the field. And it's very, very difficult in therapy to get people to understand something they've never experienced.
Right.
And so, and I think that's one of the great vulnerabilities for any undue influence too, because people have something inside themselves that they're looking for.
Right.
If you're unscrupulous enough, you then offer, or you're deluded enough,
right,
you offer the solution to it,
right,
without people even knowing that's there. And I think that's a really important point that Dan made, you know, in his work, you know, filling that omission need.
Yeah, and I want to just say, you know, Dan passed away, but for decades, I was going to his workshops, and then I got invited to a professional support group where we would do case presentations, and he would give us lectures on the whole topic and then talk about how he would approach it. And he really set the stage for my interest in forensics, like how to explain to courts of law what's going on with undue influence. But I just want to say that for me, working with people born in cults and they come out and they maybe read Combating Cult Mind Control, the original one didn't talk about people born in cults. It was based on my Mooney experience. So they're like, I don't know what's normal. I don't know, you know, what's a family supposed to be like? I didn't know my parents, or I was raised communally, or I was passed around sexually with 25 other adults. So you have to explain to them what's normal and healthy. And that led to the influence continuum model, where I had to explain to people, here's the healthy side. You know, here's what healthy parents are supposed to believe and do. And for them, it was revelatory.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's interesting, isn't it? One of the things that we're really keen on, and we kind of implement into our trainings now, is just really kind of looking into much more detail at the developmental psychology literature. It's something that seems to have dropped off the radar to some extent down here in our training. The idea that we emerge from a, you know, I mean, we all start the same way. We're a couple of, you know, little zygotes that fuse into a cell that differentiates, and we go from there. And everything that happens to us along that whole path is building an embodied sense of who we are. So, you know, we start as sensate creatures. Right. You know, we're born not seeing and hearing. We get those functions come online in our first few days of life through safe relationship.
Yeah.
As we develop, then the limbic brain grows and we start to experience affect through relationship. And it's only after all that gets stabilized in the first couple of years, and this is the whole point about attachment, you know, the felt sense of who we are is already built before we acquire language.
Right.
And so for people born into cults, they're born into a way of being in the world that, as you say, they don't know a difference. It's like almost built into the body.
Yes.
When we're exposed to these experiences, and so having techniques that can take people back in and recreate those experiences becomes critical and essential. But it has to be done in that collaborative vein, so that we're not doing too, as you pointed out really early on. There's so much clinical work is I'm an expert, you're sick.
Right.
I'm going to do this to you, and it's such a, I find it like appallingly abusive, you know, that we take on these power and control positions. Usually, you know, it's done from goodwill, but, you know, it's nonetheless this kind of, you know, colonizing of the mind of other through our expertise, you know, and I think it's a real problem. I mean, it doesn't have to be that way. We can bring our expertise in, as you were saying yourself, to support people's emergence of mind, to support people's developing autonomy and mastery of mental processes. I think, you know, that kind of coaching is you know, what needs to happen much more widely.
Yeah, totally. So I'm so excited and looking forward to learning from you, and hopefully, you know, we'll videotape and have real life people willing to learn and grow and teach with us what they need.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a really important part. Getting those what we've been doing in our training is really trying to capture that real live explication of how these processes work, because showing and demonstrating is really, you know, a key way of learning, isn't it? Yep. And we're really pretty excited about actually starting to look systematically about how we can train and support and help therapists understand, particularly organization of mind issues.
Yes.
You know, so often, you know, we end up treating something as a pathology, an anxiety or a depression, yeah, when what that person's actually doing is having a normal reaction,
right,
to an abnormal system.
Right. Yeah, and really the world is an abnormal system for the most part, and healthy families and healthy cultural communities is abnormal. So it's such a vital thing. And I guess I want to just reflect, because I've been spending a lot of time learning about AI and learning about neuroscience, and I'm really crystallizing, at least for the moment, with the real recognition that we're embodied minds and we need to be in real life with human beings. Like, I can have sessions over Zoom, but it's qualitatively not close to being as good or effective as being in the same room, in the same space. And just because there's so many mirror neurons also, and we're just our guts picking up things that our conscious minds are oblivious to, but we're feeling it. And I see this push towards the virtual reality and avatars and all of that, and it's just not healthy for the human mind. It may fit people who are neuroatypical, who are uncomfortable being with humans, but I really wonder what's going on in utero that may be setting people up to not feel comfortable being with human beings, or whether it's an issue just something genetic, but also epigenetic. The environmental system isn't filling the gaps in a healthy way.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. That's something we noted. I'm down here in Melbourne. We were the world's second most shut down city during COVID. Mm. So a lot of our work went to, like everyone else around the world, a lot of our work went to online format. And what was really interesting, and it took me a while to work this out, but when we're doing therapy online and we're not physically present with someone, so they can't feel our presence in the room, I can't feel them, I can't get all those senses. What was actually happening, I noticed with myself and a number of my supervisees, was an amplification of the omission.
Say more.
People didn't realize that, you know, there was so much omission in their background. So they hadn't had the care, they hadn't had the attention of another. You know, it might be benign neglect. You know, it might be that grew up in families where the parents were just busy and distracted. But whatever it was, it amplifies. And until you can name that and work through it and find some workarounds, what was happening is people were just getting symptomatically more amplified. Particularly when we were talking about people carrying trauma, which, you know, I personally think lies at the base of most psychological distress anyway, is some form of traumatic response. And I think, you know, the other point you're making very very clearly there around AI and around avatars and the way that the internet works is really, really answering a problem that we don't, again, address very clearly. And that's one that Dan Brown used to talk about a lot, is the problem of mind wandering. You know, we've got minds that chase things, and they chase things in order to avoid stuff. You know, if we've got difficulties that are just hard to face, and we're being told that we shouldn't be feeling bad or we shouldn't be feeling anxious, then we're setting ourselves up just to distract. Our concentration spans have halved over the last generation because the way that we're using technology, and it doesn't have to be that way. I think there's lots of really useful things that could be done on this interconnected global community. But at the moment we're putting all our energy into distracting people.
So true. And I interviewed a social psychiatrist, Carl Marcy, about his book Rewired. And this is a peer-reviewed Harvard University publication. And he said that from his studies, children shouldn't be on screens for at least the first 3 years, like not even TV screens. They just need to be with humans a lot. And not just mom and dad, but other humans, to smell them, to breathe with them, to feel, as you say, to be present and have it feel safe to be in your body in real time.
You know, I didn't grow up in the most ideal of family systems, but at least my parents spent time helping me paint or making models, and there was, and I had brothers, and I had grandparents, and I had other relatives. So there's an attention that we give to children when they're focusing on task that makes the child feel good about themselves. Connected to other and focused. And what that does is that builds the linkage around the anterior cingulate gyrus, which is that part of the brain that links the limbic and the prefrontal, so it links the animal and human brain. And when we develop the anterior cingulate gyrus, we develop the concentration of dopamine in those regions, you know, the learning molecule or the brain reward system. And so children learn to focus their attention.
Yes.
And they do that as something that the biofeedback that they experience from attention feels good for them. So they develop self-esteem and attention. And we're really neglecting those as qualities of, you know, support for children in the community that you know we're all sort of occupying at the moment. And you'd know from, you know, your work with particularly people raised in cults, a lot of what goes on is people are distracted and they're given dogma or they're given task and they're actually turned away from that focus on the development of a healthy self that's autonomous, that's supported, that feels good, because this distractibility is amplified by anyone who wants to learn how to control another person.
Yeah, and I might also add there are certain cults like Scientology, Jehovah's Witnesses, to just name two of many, that kind of treat their children as adults. They're not allowed to play and have just frivolous, exploratory, pleasurable, adventurous. You know, a little bit of risk taking even is okay. They're not allowed to do that, and they're even corporally punished if they do be that way. So then there's that behavior modification piece, that to train obedience versus training to be authentic to yourself.
No, that's a great point. I recently had a conversation with Mark Soames, who is done a lot of work, and he's published a number of books in applying neuropsych to developmental processes and to psychoanalysis. He's a South African who now works in England. And we're talking about the role of play, and he was explaining play as a neural circuit in the limbic brain. You know, lion cubs play, wolf cubs play, human beings play, and what happens when a child or any animal is exposed to healthy and supported play as an adult, they're then more flexible and adaptable to changes in circumstance. They're more autonomous.
Yes.
So that for an animal, they're able to hunt and respond to, you know, threats in their environment much more agilely.
Yes.
Than had they not been able to play. So denying children the opportunity to play creates rigidity in adults.
Yeah, and parents should model the play, right? And it's also a way of transmission of how we do things, you know, and such.
Yeah.
But I want to come back for a minute because I was just at a conference and there was so much emphasis in a couple of presenters on mindfulness meditation. But then there was one of Dan's students teaching a two-hour pointing out way concentration meditation that totally surprised me that it was being done. But there's so many people who think mindfulness is great. I personally don't. I'm more the Dan Brown concentration meditation. Tell me what you think.
Yeah, mindfulness. It's quite odd the way that mindfulness has been brought in. Particularly, it's down here. It's all the rage in clinical work.
Yeah, that's why I'm bringing it up. It's the rage here too in the States.
It's everywhere, and it's interesting because mindfulness is really a feature of Theravadan practice. Mm-hmm. And that's what is commonly described as the first turning of the wheel in Buddhist practice. Mm-hmm. So it's basically the earliest development of Buddhism. And then there were two later developments. So mindfulness is part of the what's sometimes described as the Hinayana process. Mm-hmm. Or and then we move into Mahayana, which is your beginning of your concentration practices. So mindfulness is a part of all meditative technique, mm-hmm. but it's a part. And so it's a skill of being able to sit, watch, and observe. But, you know, being able to sit, watch, and observe for, you know, you could do that for 3 weeks and not make structural change.
Right.
What the concentration, so mindfulness moves on to samatha practice, concentration practice, which is a way of learning to use your mind and to direct it. And to use your mind to move towards features of mind. And it's all about developing this sort of sense of autonomy and mastery,
right.
Which mindfulness is teaching us non-reactivity, which is a very important feature,
right.
But it's not the whole show.
Right.
And so what tends to happen, and a friend of mine was in London at a conference and was talking to a leader in mindfulness based stress reduction, and my friend was an academic in Melbourne, and she had quite a strong meditative practice, and spoke to this academic who was teaching mindfulness based stuff to talk to her about meditation. She said, "What's that? Why be involved in that? We're just teaching mindfulness. It's not understood as part of a incredibly deep and rich cultural tradition,
uh-huh.
for one, but a cultural tradition that's evolved."
Right.
To incorporate mindfulness into a whole series of other practices that are a lot more useful for the West. And, you know, one of the main things about concentration practice, samatha practice, is it's a cure for mind wandering.
Yeah, so what I've heard described as monkey mind, where, you know, you're bouncing and, you know, guilty. Yeah. It was called ADD, you know, but learning that, you know what, I want to focus and keep my attention in ever increasing amounts of time because I want to track my breath and the turning of between the inhale and the exhale was a very different practice of meditation that Dan taught.
Yeah. 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 And you know, it's teaching a mastery of mind.
Yeah.
And the deeper you go into the practice, the more the qualities of mind become clear, the more you see how much, you know, vision and sound and language constrain and constrict and approximate. Mm. And you see that very, very clearly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you've studied breath work too, as part of your curiosity and your growing. And it just seems, I want to just say, I listened to a video from, I guess, 2006 or so from Linda Stone. She was talking about being online and suffering email apnea, which was a new term I'd never heard. But she was talking about how people are holding their breath. They're not breathing as they're doing emails. And because this heightened, and I got to do it right now. Talk to me about breathing and its importance, and give some listeners some tips on healthy breathing, please.
Yeah, yeah. Habab Dabanlu coined a term called striatic anxiety to explain, you know, this issue that we forget when we're activated and when we've got this adrenal function going, which is what I think is going on when people are desperately going through their emails and, you know, trying to react. They're in a reactive state. Mm-hmm. You know, their body is saying biologically there's a threat. So then their body does whatever their body's learned to do. So striatic anxiety is a little bit like getting ready to be tackled, you know, in a sports game or something. The body just tenses up, does it naturally. The diaphragm happens to be another muscle, and the diaphragm controls the regulation of the lungs. So when we tense up in our shoulders and our back, and we don't even know we're doing it because we've been doing it since we were little kids, and the diaphragm tenses up. So volume of oxygen reduces, and then our good old cerebellum starts thinking that we're being buried alive or drowned or something. And so we get this discharge of anxiety, of adrenaline. Right. Tries to make our body do something, but there's no environmental threat other than a bunch of emails.
Right.
So awareness becomes the critical feature. And a lot of the work I do is just, you know, helping people understand that they're carrying physiological tension.
Yes.
Most people I talk to don't even know that it's there. So now this is all about breathing, is about a conscious act of not just sucking in oxygen, but relaxing your entire body to allow the experience of the air to circulate, to slow down, to release the diaphragm, to allow the lungs to deepen in their breath and take conscious breath.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's one of the main features that people come in with anxiety problems, is that they're in this striatic anxiety state. They're constantly tense. Their mind's wandering all over the place because no one's taught them just to sit quietly,
yep,
breathe slowly, reduce the external stimuli. Even if you take a moment and look away from your computer, if you've got a window or a painting or an object in your room, just to draw your attention onto a singular feature and slowly breathe.
Right.
The breath work you're referring to, I did with Grof, was accelerated breathing.
Mm.
Breathing deeper and faster, and you do that to music, and that creates a whole set of different features of mind.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of breath work out there that doesn't have a lot of sort of structured form to it. Mm-hmm. So I don't ever advocate for people to do that kind of accelerated breathing by themselves, because it,
you don't recommend it. No.
Not the accelerated breathing.
I know Rajneesh was having people do it as a technique of rendering them more susceptible to control.
Yeah, because it creates an unordinary state of mind.
Right, but I am guilty, and I'm genuinely doing my best to reprogram my habits to do diaphragmatic breathing. Instead of just breathing shallowly at the top of my chest. And I've also read a book called Breath. I'm forgetting who wrote it, but he talks about breathing in and out through your nose and not breathing through your mouth. And then when I was listening to Linda Stone yesterday, she was talking about upregulating your parasympathetic nervous system by breathing in to the count of three, holding it for two, and exhaling for the count of six.
Yeah.
And by intentionally doing that, we invoke our parasympathetic system and we relax.
Correct. Yeah.
What a revelation in this mad world where everyone's rushing all the time to relax and to actually know there's a method you can do that. And you don't need to pay for it. You just need to remember to regulate. And one of the techniques Dan taught me and us decades ago was the power of asking the client on a scale of 1 to 10, how present are you feeling or how resourceful to teach people that they can create a measuring stick in their mind and actually calibrate it for themselves. And then, by asking it several times through an hour, people start automatically doing it on their own, that they can regulate their own and be aware of their own states.
Yeah. That's really where Dan was coming in with this sort of metacognitive material. What you're doing is you're teaching your mind that it can gain mastery.
Exactly.
Yeah, so we can start to understand, like, and you know, you're describing in the brief the different, there are lots of different techniques in regulating breath, and you know, the Hindus call it pranayama, and it's been going for many thousands of years in India, and the Tibetans do have very similar practices, as do the Chinese, in embedded in their cultures. And yeah, we've known for a very long time that breathing, conscious breathing, regulates the body. But we spend so much of our time running between, you know, the next, you know, app and the next device and the next meeting and the next, we're not present to ourselves in this culture. And then we get people telling us that there's something pathological going on. You know, if you spend all day running, chasing your mind from one point to the next whilst you're holding your breath, gee, I wonder why you're experiencing anxiety. Right. I wonder why you're showing these signs and these symptoms. And then suddenly it's pathologized and there's a pill for it.
Right. Yeah, Big Pharma wants to sell pills. And this whole notion that, you know, more is better, so work harder, spend more hours. All the research says, you know, a shorter work week is actually going to be more productive, giving time off where you're not doing things just to have deep relaxation and deep thought about things is going to improve productivity and creativity and a million other things, right?
Yeah. Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir discovered through experimentation that 6 hours was their maximum productive day.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went off and did their stuff afterwards.
Yeah, well, I need to practice because I'm working way too many hours. And all I can say is life is a journey and trying my best to apply and not just teach, but actually live what I'm learning. Can we switch gears for a minute? Because right now another rage is psychedelic therapies here in the States. And some states are more advanced than others, but there is funding going to clinicians. And I did interview Rachel Harris, who is a PhD and who did some government research projects on this. Tell us about your take on this and what's good about it, what's bad about it, and cautions.
Because of my interest in holotropic breathwork, holotropic breathwork was developed by Stan and Christina Groff during their stay at Esalen on the west coast of California back in the late 70s, and it was developed because Stan had been a primary researcher in clinical application of LSD. There's a huge body of literature on its potential and efficacy from the 50s right up until the early 70s. Then Nixon decided that a drug that was introduced to society that could change the way people voted wasn't such a good idea, so prohibition was introduced. And we had this long period where there was no activity, and in that time, holotropic breath work was a way of kind of preserving skills, but also creating a non-ordinary state that wasn't drug induced. And then in recent times, for instance, the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, who have developed a lot of the work on MDMA for PTSD, they use a Groff model of practice in their protocols. What psychedelics seem to do is they can, when they work, is break the rigidity of mental organization. This is something called the default mode network. It's being hypothesized by Robin Carhart Harris, amongst others. And it's this linkage between the three stages of the brain, typically described as a reptilian, mammalian, and human brain, the brainstem, limbic cortex. And we adapt very early in life to a kind of a way of experiencing that's quite rigid. And so when people don't respond to psychological treatments, what seems to be happening is that there's a rigidification of the way that they're experiencing and processing information. Yep. So when you give people a psychedelic in a supported environment under the right conditions in the right way, that kind of rigidity breaks down and new opportunities arise. So through neuroplasticity, you were mentioning earlier, through neurogenesis, new pathways are possible. Now, what the danger of psychedelics is, and all the attention, and I've trained about 300 clinicians in Australia now in the use of psychedelics. Really? And we've I've just run the first MDMA sessions for clinicians in training just recently. It's not the medicine that's significant here. It's the fact that people get a disruption to the rigidity of their thinking. And what we need to be thinking about as a community is the best way to support the emergence of new functions of mind that are autonomous, that are self-regulating, because, there's going to be a lot of... people are impressionable when they're in a non-ordinary state, and that impressionability, is very, very significant during the process of neurogenesis, which is for about 5 days after they've induced a psychedelic. So people are very impressionable. So what we do as therapists can have really, really quite profound impact. So if we come in thinking we're the expert, thinking we've got it worked out and we've got a model of, being in the world, that we can impose that onto someone's impressionable mind.
Right.
And I think that's the real... real subtle danger in the work. So psychedelics are really kind of an interesting kind of way of giving people a very rapid experience of there's a lot more going on in this skull than I knew about.
Right.
And that my suffering is not me.
Right.
And that there are other ways to be, but I need some support to stabilize that.
Right. So but this is all about doing it with a therapist who's properly trained with the right ethics, not just going off and tripping or doing mushrooms or MDMA at a rave party and hoping that everything's going to be fine, because it can really cause damage.
Yeah, and that's a lot of the work I've been doing over many years now is, helping people kind of, extract themselves from that damage, because without understanding what you're doing to your mind, if you go off to a rave party, a lot of people do this and have a good time and that's all great, but, you get stuck on an aspect of mind that isn't quite so great, which is what people call a bad trip. There's very little scaffolding to help people emerge from that. So what I often get are referrals from people that have been caught up in the psychiatric system. What's happened is they've had some kind of experience that's unresolved and unintegrated. Right. They turn up to a very conservative medical practice and the person views them as psychotic.
Yeah, they give them a box, a label.
Yeah, and immediately start to try and repress symptoms.
Right.
Now, what we know with integration of, these sort of states is that they need time and they need support.
Right.
And very often they'll resolve themselves.
Right.
shut them down straight away and they will not resolve themselves.
Yep, exactly. So I'm going to go out on a limb and bring up a topic I hadn't planned to at all. But as we're recording this, a violent, murderous attack happened at a rave party where a lot of people were on MDMA and tripping. Yep. And a lot of their friends are now murdered. They had to hide for hours where guns were being shot. What do we do for the 100 people who survived that nightmare?
Yeah. You're talking about the Israeli?
Yes.
Yeah. Terrific stuff. Horrific stuff. You know, and what's going to – because when you take these state change technologies, you're moving the organization of mind into a domain that isn't our day-to-day operation.
Right.
You're getting people in touch with symbolic form, which is a very early primitive organization feature of mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, you know, kind of imprinting and impression is really most strongly kind of lodged.
Right.
And so people are getting traumatized when they're in a non-ordinary state. Then what you're getting is the potential for extreme symbolic organization of that material into that person's day-to-day life,
right,
on top of the more regular features of PTSD. So they're going to need a lot of supportive integration of whatever the features of experience were happening for them, and everyone will have a very different experience.
But I guess I'm curious if your experience, not that you ever worked with traumatized people explicitly or at a party where something violent happened, but might it be necessary to have them do MDMA to heal that trauma or not necessarily? Any speculation?
Yeah, it would be a case-by-case basis. You know, I've worked with people that have been, say, assaulted or raped while they were under the influence of psychedelics.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, at that level, you know, you've just got to work through the way in which that person has experienced and recorded the information. And so and Israel's a world leader in MDMA for PTSD. And that's in part because there's so much PTSD in the culture, in the culture and country. Because of all of the ongoing and almost ceaseless conflicts that occur over there.
Yeah, I didn't know that about Israel. I recently saw a documentary on cannabis in Israel and that they're allowing elderly people who find it a great relief to their suffering. But I didn't know about MDMA.
Yeah. They're world leaders in the implementation of protocols for reorganization of mind.
Yeah. And of course, the collateral damage of victims in Palestine as well as Israelis is just horrific. And
without an understanding of organization of mind, without a cultural understanding of what an optimized mind looks like when it's supported through life, we'll get this collapse into barbarism going on all the time.
Yeah,
you know, because it's a primitive state of mental organization. It's response to suffering. It's a consequence of intergenerational trauma.
Right.
It's a feature of the brain that where adrenal cortical dominance occurs.
Right.
Where if we're adrenally and cortically dominant, then things look like threats. Things need to be attacked. Yeah.
Right.
And if we're not understanding that we're driven by those neurotransmitters, and it's a much more healthy life being driven by dopamine and serotonin, and we don't help build structures that lift people to that awareness,
yes,
then these kind of repeat traumas go on. I mean, that's what's collapsing in Russia at the moment as well.
Yeah.
You know, it collapses into primitivism.
So true. So if you had your way and you had unlimited resources, aside from us doing a training and recording it and putting it online, if there are public health officials from different world governments listening, Maybe you can just fantasize out loud some of the wishful, you know, protocols that you would.
Yeah, you're very simply training people to understand that there's a bit of psychoed about what an optimized mind looks like, what the potential of a mind is, which we all benefit from when we have geniuses or creative people or, you know, technically astute people. So creating opportunities for minds to optimize culturally is absolutely imperative. And we do that by, at the ground level, each of us learning how our minds work and how they're embodied and what our body does historically to trip us up and culturally how we support a lot of that aggression and a lot of that power and control, which is all adrenocortical induction. We understand that. We start to mature as a species in our understanding of how our minds work. And it's not that difficult. We've got sensations, we've got affects, we've got cognitions. They build developmentally across time with increasing levels of sophistication, and they're all experienced through a relationship. It's not that hard.
Right. And wouldn't it be a different world if before people had children, they were taught how to be a good parent and what a good parent is? Acts and what they don't do, and they don't just, you know, replicate their own childhoods and all the problems that their mommy and daddy unknowingly did.
Exactly. I had a couple in my room for couples therapy, and they brought their 8-month-old in and put the 8-month-old on a little mat on the floor. And they then, I invited them to have a conversation. So they started squabbling with each other. And I spent 20 minutes doing goo-goo gagas with the child whose face lit up, who was responsive emotionally. And then I kind of turned to the parents and said, do you notice what's happening here? Mm. That child was completely left alone. If I wasn't there engaging the child, they were so lost in their petty conflicts that this little brain was being starved of what it needs to grow.
Yeah, so you were modeling.
Modeling.
But you weren't making them feel guilty. You were just trying to offer an example of the kinds of things they could be doing.
Exactly. And we have no cultural understanding of the importance of developing brains and the sensitivity of developing brains. You know, with the psychedelic work, you step into that sensitivity momentarily. While the medicine's working, and we're trying to then unpick all the bad habits that have developed through no fault of the person, just a fault of the community to not value our growth, our development, and our potential.
Right. I want to add a personal thing because that's what I do on the influence continuum. I became a parent at age 50. My wife and I decided to adopt, and I did a workshop with an adoption specialist herself, an adoptee, Joyce Pavo, who I've interviewed. But just the idea that the goal of being a healthy parent is to be authoritative, not authoritarian. That the goal of being a parent is to recognize each child is unique and your job is to be a good steward to help the child developmentally become themselves, not to be a clone of Steve and that's the goal, and to always think I could do it for the child or I could set the conditions and encourage the child to experiment and make mistakes and learn from its mistakes, which is going to empower self-esteem and stop just blindly praising how smart a kid is, but, you know, praise them for the effort at figuring things out is going to inculcate a love of learning and self-efficacy. Yeah. And this was all stuff I had to learn. Nobody taught me these things. Yeah. But wow, the world would be so different if people understood, you know.
And it's not like we don't have the science. It's not like we don't have the knowledge. We just haven't brought it into culture.
Right. And then I want to if I may, just criticize the standard industrial revolution formula for education, which was batch education according to age and with standardized tests. And I was bored silly in elementary school. I was reading graduate level stuff. I just was bored. And the idea that education could be customized to where what the child is interested in, and you go with amplifying their interests and building on existing skills as a formula for education. Wow, that's a different formula.
Yeah, exactly. A friend of mine, the late Professor Peter Russo, did a lot of work in the critique of fear-based education.
Mm-hmm.
The way that we motivate children here and right across the world is to make them fearful of failure. And what we're inviting then is amplification of the amygdala. We're amplification of adrenocortical systems, which we know reduce the optimization of the brain and the mind.
Yeah. Very true. And competitive versus cooperative. There was studies that the jigsaw classroom, where every child was given a part of the lesson plan to learn and share and teach their fellow classmates, is far superior to having a teacher at the front in memorization. But why aren't we implementing it?
And they're engaging the collaborative system there.
Exactly. And they need each other to share. So we've seemed to have lost Nigel, but we were at the end of the influence continuum, and I'm so excited and looking forward to traveling to Melbourne, Australia, and we're aiming at March of 2024 to do this training. So with that, we'll sign off. Thanks so much.
That's it for today's episode of The Influence Continuum. I've been your host, Dr. Stephen Hassan. Theme music for the podcast is by Nasser Malik. To keep up to date with me and happenings that I think are important, please visit my website at freedomofmind.com. There you'll find in-depth articles about cults, mind control, and other relevant topics. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at CultExpert. If you want to develop a comprehensive understanding of these topics, I highly recommend my books, Combating Cult Mind Control, Freedom of Mind, and The Cult of Trump, in that order. These books are a culmination of 45 plus years of experience and will really help you grasp the complex web of undue influence. I have also launched a new 9-hour online course for anyone interested in a deep dive into issues related to recovering from undue influence in all forms. While this course is designed for clinicians, everyone can benefit. If you're a former member, I congratulate you for your bravery and invite you to use the hashtag IGotOut and join our online community at IGotOut.org. Remember, love is stronger than mind control. And thanks for listening.